Armando Ruiz is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Ruiz to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for nearly half of all executions in the U.S. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, Paige Yannick, Sharon Bass, and Monica Ishtan. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Pat Hartwell, Houston Vigil reporter Jennifer Simmons. The execution watch for Rolando Ruiz begins.
Thank you, Victoria Panetti, for giving us that song, and thank you, Larry Douglas, for giving us the voice of God for our introduction tonight. My name is Ray Hill, and we're doing an Execution Watch show on the occasion of the execution of Rolando Ruiz. Pat is now on the air from Huntsville. Pat, what's going on in Huntsville?
Well, there are about 40 family members out here, and right now, as per Rolando's request, all of them are gathered in a prayer circle with his the pictures on the poster in the middle, and they're praying. They know that the Supreme Court has not ruled yet, but they have chosen to do what Rolando has asked them to do for now. His mother is in a walker, and she's unable to walk. She's with oxygen. And she is on the edge of the circle, very emotional. The entire family is very emotional.
Yes, I suspected. We learned from last prison show that there was a large contingent of the Ruiz family in Huntsville because they called in the show, and there was many voices on that. So we were alerted that the Ruiz's are gathered here in support of them. Can you tell how many people are actually going to go in and witness, if any?
Yes, he has chosen two of his brothers to witness. And they're in the administration building waiting. You know, obviously there's no phone and they don't give them any information, so they don't know what's going on. And they can't see us, you know that.
Yeah.
However, we are very encouraged. We all know that the Walls is a working prison. And we always have prisoners up on that second, is it the second floor?
Yeah, it's the first floor
with
windows.
And they hold up their signs and they hold up their fists, and that is their way of showing solidarity.
It is the first floor with windows. Actually, that's the third floor, Pat.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's the third floor.
I've never been behind there other than to the execution chamber.
Yeah, I have lived in the Walls, so I know what's up.
And they show their solidarity, and I want the guys to know that his family, during the last phone call, gave him the messages of all the guys on the row.
Good. So. And other than the family, are there other vigilants?
Yes, there's about, I would say, maybe 15 of us. There's a young man that lives in Huntsville that has just walked up, and he told me that he opposed executions, and he wants to show his solidarity. We have two people from Norway who just happened by and that are standing politely at the edge.
Okay, Pat, would you alert Elizabeth if any movement happens?
I sure will, and y'all tell me if the Supreme Court rules. Y'all hear it first.
Well, Elizabeth will hear it. I'm in the studio. I might not get word until after she gets it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And now Jennifer is ready. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hello, Ray.
Hey.
I am here at the corner of Shepherd and Westheim. We're in front of St. Anne's Catholic Church. We have 5 or 6 or 7 people here. Thankfully, the rain has held off long enough for us to be here, and we'd like to express our sympathies to the families of Rolando Ruiz and Charissa Rodriguez. I'd also like to inform you that there is a second vigil going on tonight in Harris County. There was some interest among members who live up in Spring, and this is the first night that they have gathered together to have a vigil.
You know, that's Linda White's church, and I was up
yes.
there speaking recently, and Linda
yes.
Linda is a Victims Families for Reconciliation
right,
organization,
right.
and her daughter was brutally raped and murdered.
Yes, yes.
And
I've
then
heard
she
her
had,
story. She's a powerful speaker, and there were quite a few people up there who were asking us about organizing a vigil there, and we hope that they have a good attendance tonight and they find it rewarding. And a lot of our people who come into Houston actually live closer to the Spring location, so whichever one they can go to is most convenient. We just want to get people out with signs and interacting with the public here, which we're just
for further information, check with Plymouth United Church of Christ in Spring.
Well, yes, actually, I think it's a congregational church. I don't think it's Church of Christ. I could be wrong.
Oh, though, okay. They may have changed the nomenclature since I was
yeah. They can go to the TCA website, which always lists the locations of the vigils in Texas, and that vigil location would be listed on the TCADP.org website.
TCADP.org is the website for the
yes,
Texas Coalition.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, yes. And so we have had some encouraging honks here. I find the people in Houston to usually be pretty polite when they see us here. They've come to expect us on this corner.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, right. And
oh, by the way, no witnesses have crossed the road. We're still pending in the Supreme Court.
Okay, Ray. Thank you very much for calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Monica?
Yes, sir?
Welcome to Execution Watch.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about this case.
All right. So Rolando Ruiz was convicted in Bexar County in 1995 for being the shooter in the murder for hire of Teresa Rodriguez. Ruiz was hired by Teresa's husband, Michael Rodriguez, and Michael's brother, Mark Rodriguez. The two brothers agreed to pay Luis $2,000, $1,000 up front and $1,000 afterwards to kill Teresa so that Michael could collect on the life insurance policies totaling $250,000. Also, before the killing, Michael actually applied for additional life insurance policies of $150,000 each on himself and his wife. Ruiz ended up shooting Teresa once in the head in the garage of her home as she stepped out of her house, or of her car, I apologize. Ruiz was arrested after a telephone tip to authorities and after Teresa's employer, USAA Insurance Firm, offered a $50,000 reward for information about her slaying. Ruiz ended up also confessing to the scheme in three different police statements. Ruiz is one of five men charged in this case with capital murder. The other four men took pleas in exchange for life prison terms, including the two Rodriguez brothers who hired him. However, actually in December of 2000, Michael Rodriguez, the husband of Teresa, escaped from the prison as a member of one of the Texas Seven and wound up on death row. There were some issues raised that Ruiz's defense counsel failed to follow some leads given in a psychologist's report that could have helped Ruiz. The report was not introduced at trial, but it claimed that Ruiz was abused as a child and it led him to alcohol and substance abuse, that he had trouble distinguishing between fantasy and reality, and that he had probably killed Teresa during a significant reduced mental capacity resulting from the effects of alcohol or other intoxicants. Ruiz's defense counsel testified later that they didn't investigate those claims because they believed that it was going to backfire on them. The reasons they thought it was going to backfire was that they thought that either the jury may start to believe that he was a future danger, and also if that he also was involved in a mini riot after his arrest, and that he did not have any drugs or alcohol in his system then, so that wouldn't really help his case in those senses. At the punishment phase of his trial, the state presented evidence demonstrating Ruiz's violent nature and propensity through testimony of Ruiz's friends and acquaintances. Samuel Perez testified that Ruiz was violent and carried guns. Christian Villarreal testified that she had also known Ruiz to carry guns, that he frequently got into fights, that she was concerned Ruiz would shoot the police when they came to arrest him, and that in her opinion, Ruiz has no conscience. Rodolfo Espinoza testified that he and Ruiz were in a neighborhood gang and that Ruiz preferred to resolve disputes through use of violence rather than conversation. The state also presented evidence of Ruiz's prior conviction for aggravated robbery that he committed on June 8, 1992. The evidence showed that Ruiz dragged his then-girlfriend, Roxanne Conway, out of her truck, beat her with his fists, and then proceeded to kick her teeth out with his boots. She admitted to fearing for her life at the time of the assault. Ruiz then dragged another woman out of that truck, stole the truck, and then the truck was later found vandalized a few minutes later. There was also evidence presented of Ruiz's violent misconduct while he was in jail. A Bexar County detention officer testified that on one occasion, Ruiz charged out of his cell an attempt to attack another inmate, and that it took two officers to subdue Ruiz after this incident. And lastly, they produced evidence showing that Ruiz was a member of the Texas Syndicate prison gang, and that on September 6, 1992, Ruiz and three members of the gang attacked an inmate who was being returned to his cell, which resulted in a detention officer being struck in the face. On April 21, 1993, Ruiz was involved in another altercation in which four detention officers were assaulted, and a video recording of that portion of the incident was played for the jury.
Mercy. But the thing that jumped out at me is there's as many cast members to this original homicide as there is to Macbeth. Is there five people involved?
Yeah. Well, yes, right. Five people were charged.
I mean, one of them's a husband.
Yes.
And so then he wants his wife killed. So he goes, gets his brother, and they look for Ruiz. What about the other two? I mean,
I don't have any information about the other two that were involved in the murder.
You know, it's kind of like trying to write a poem by committee.
It does appear that the brother of the husband, or the brother-in-law to the decedent, was the one who established initial contact with Ruiz, and that eventually the husband, who was the brother, yeah, and that's Michael. Okay, Mark is the brother-in-law to the decedent, and Michael is the husband to the decedent. Anyway, Michael does give him the down payment, and Michael is supposed to follow up with $1,000 after the execution is carried out.
Okay.
And Ruiz, does receive $2,000 grand total, and then subsequently, you know, he is arrested and he gives his statement.
So apparently Ruiz got a very good accounts receivable department.
Well, I don't know that I would brag about the accounts receivable.
Well, he collected.
He did collect, which is frequently much more than I can.
Well, after you've hired somebody to kill somebody, you know, you can shrug your shoulders and walk away from that on the second payment. So the accounts receivable department must be very persuasive.
Well, the evidence at punishment concerning his
persuasiveness
and propensity for violence does tend to go along with that.
Now, the player was the husband, was part of the
Texas Seven.
The Connolly Seven.
Yes.
And he has been executed.
Yes, indeed, he was executed. He was executed August the 8th. Of 2008.
I think we did a show about that execution. I think we referred to him as a volunteer. He asked his appeals.
He was a volunteer. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, and you will find that on the website of executionwatch.org. It's everything we've done is in there. Susan, what bring you to the table?
Well, I was just going to talk about Michael Rodriguez and his involvement. He was, like Monica and Paige said, a part of the Conley Seven, And he, in this case, he pled to a life sentence, and 8 years into his incarceration, he, along with six of his fellow roommates.
Maintenance workers.
Maintenance workers.
That's where I worked when I was in prison. Maintenance workers. Oh, I lived outside the compound. They had recently moved them from outside the compound to inside of the compound for security reasons. And the people in the maintenance department were offended by that. We are now living under closer scrutiny than we used to because of the change of the rules of the new administration of Texas Department of Criminal Justice. And so I think they got it in a circle and said, we will show them. So out of their maintenance office inside the compound, they plotted and planned, took over a guard tower,
and escaped. Yeah, and I guess maintenance workers wear plain clothes. They took their clothes, they got a prison truck, and they drove right on out of there. Rodriguez's father was also involved in the escape, and he parked the car a couple miles down the road, I believe at a Walmart. So the guys ditched the truck, had a free world truck, ditched the prison truck, and went on. About 2 weeks later, they ended up in Irving, robbed a sporting goods store, got about $70,000 cash, some guns, took some the employees' IDs, and that's where they killed Irving police officer Aubrey Hawkins.
Yeah.
And that's what Michael Rodriguez was executed for that.
And then they went on to Colorado or New Mexico.
Yes, somewhere. They were eventually captured in Colorado Springs.
Went to Colorado and rented a
like all Texans, they think
home.
Everything's better in Colorado.
Yeah, and they rented a vacation home and all moved in together. And here were all these guys that looked an awful lot like convict maintenance men.
Yeah, they joined a church, and I believe they were living in a motorhome in a trailer park. Yeah.
It's difficult to put that into your mind unless you have some familiarity with prison culture. The idea of being moved from operating an office as trustees outside the compound to being moved inside the compound, one would consider a disrespectful move to their integrity. And then once that happens in prison culture, some kind of get-even has to process, and that's an arrest. Meanwhile, I'm telling you that nothing has come over the lines. Elizabeth is in there, busy on her iPhone, trying to find out what's going on with the Supreme Court. Pat is on standby to call if any of the witnesses cross the road. It is now 6:18, and nothing has happened in the progress. What's going on in Washington, D.C. is the go-to justice for Texas execution cases and last-minute motions and appeals is Justice Thomas. It used to be Justice Scalia, and I'll tell you, Justice Scalia, one thing for sure, we got a thumbs up or a thumbs down or a finger in the wind pretty promptly with Scalia. He was Johnny on the spot. He let us know what he was going to do with this, and occasionally he would look at a case and say, well, I think I need to ask my fellow justices to look at this. And then you would get a temporary delay of the execution until that could happen, which has almost never happened on the same day. But we got something from Justice Scalia, usually before 6 o'clock. And then after 6 o'clock, if there was any delays or confusions, you would get it pretty quickly. Things work a little differently with Justice Thomas. He's a little more leisurely in his regards. Now, what happens at the Supreme Court level with these appeals is there is a clerk on executions that works for the Supreme Court of the United States, and they see these cases coming from the various courts. And so they look at all the briefs, they look at all the appeals, they look at all of the motions, they collect those ideas, and the clerks go to the judge with the entire documents, but there's also kind of an executive form of that where they say this is an issue and that is an issue that needs your attention. And so the justices are prepared by the clerk of the court that deals with execution. That sort of thing is going on in Washington, D.C. right now. The clerks have prepared the thing. No doubt they've already done that. And they're waiting for Justice Thomas to say, y'all come in and make the presentation. And then that will happen, and he will decide whether or not he can make that decision on his own. I don't see a lot about this case that Justice Thomas could not decide on his own. Of course, you got to realize that what I know about this case is what Jim has researched and shared with the other lawyers and what they presented to you. So that's my knowledge here. I know a little bit about what Pat has told me about his family, and I talked to members of his family on the prison show Friday. So I am wondering what Justice Thomas is delaying action on.
Well, Ray, I don't know that this is particular to Justice Thomas, but I do know that with the issue of mental illness that is in front of the Supremes right now, and has yet to be decided, we probably won't get a decision until the end of June, beginning of July on that case.
You think this can hide under that skirt?
I don't really see the facts in Mr. Ruiz's case as falling under that dress. However, you know, if we can talk about the punishment evidence concerning substance abuse and his blurring of fantasy and reality, then perhaps
how
that
old was he when this crime happened?
He was 20 years old when the crime happened. He's okay. Now 44.
He's now 44.
Yes. And he was, according to the evidence we saw at the punishment hearing, he was classed as, he was described as a person more prone to violence than anything else in his life. He wouldn't talk an issue out.
We got that from Monica's report, because Monica's report was pretty thorough. Monica, you have any reflection on what the Supreme Court may be pondering?
I believe that there's a lot of past things that Ruiz did that they do have to take into consideration, and I think that he definitely should take into consideration the violent nature of all of the testimonies that they
heard. Yeah, but doesn't that scream in bold headlines future dangerousness?
Indeed it does. And that was the inherent problem in this case from the very beginning for the defense lawyers. Their psychological report and their psychological expert testifying at punishment would bolster the future dangerousness allegation of the state. It would not end up assisting Mr. Ruiz and attempting to save his life. And I honestly do not know if he was the only defendant of the five that was tried for death, or if I know that all four of the others went ahead and pled to life. I don't know if he was the only one that was qualified for death or not. I just am not aware of that.
Okay. But whenever you have a cast of five characters, what goes on in the dealing with the prosecutor on your way to the courthouse can be pretty Macbethian in and of itself.
I was thinking Richard III, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, Richard. Mike Gillespie has bellied up to the bar here. Mike, this could have been your client.
I would have been up on efficiency of counsel. This is a very interesting case, and unfortunately or fortunately, you have so many people involved in this and the death of a woman. And the thing that strikes me is that the only one to get the death penalty is the shooter. Now, as we've just talked about, we do not know if everybody was offered life and he decided to try it. which would explain why he got death and not life. I would imagine, though, that if that was an option, that would be one of the issues in the efficiency of counsel, is why didn't the counsel plead the case out rather than go to trial? So you have to assume, to me, that the offer was death, not life. With that said, the issue that I'm here to talk about is the efficiency of the counsel. What the Strickland test says is that all counsels must give substantial performance, and if the performance is not substantial, if not for the direct result of it, it would have been a difference. It's a very difficult burden. You have to prove not only that the lawyer did something bad, but that there would have been a difference, and that's hard to do. The issue that this man came up with at first sounds good, that the reason he was like that was because of drugs, alcohol, violence in his life, in his background. And these are the things already talked about. They sound good, but then becomes a trial decision, as was also talked about. Once you use that, you can open it up to look even worse, because during the time period between the killing and the time of the trial, he had done other violent things in prison where there was no alcohol and drugs. So trying on one hand to say the excuse is alcohol and drugs, and then they're going to show he acted the same without alcohol and drugs. The lawyers,
that's an assumption on your part. You assume that they're not getting alcohol and drugs. But I need to interrupt for just a second to tell the folks that I know you're listening to Execution Watch, and you would like to hear a little Spanish here every once in a while. After all, the guy they're killing is Hispanic surnamed. But you can listen to Nuestra Palabra if you use your computer instead of your FM radio and go to kpft.org and go to HD3. And that's where Nuestra Palabra is. And they're doing a real program. They all bellied up to the microphones over there. They're doing a heart's work in an adjacent studio. This is Execution Watch, and we take preference. We get to right away when somebody's being killed, because that's an important issue in Texas, and they are right on the sideline, and they're over there doing it on HD radio on KPFT. Listen up. Excuse me, Mike, okay. I had to explain all that. But with every one of these people had to have different lawyers.
That's right.
Because one lawyer can't represent That's two right. people because of the possible conflict of interest between them.
But all the other lawyers pled out.
All the other lawyers may have been given an opportunity
exactly
for that.
Right.
And did any of them testify in his trial?
The other defendants?
Yeah.
No, I did not see that.
Okay.
The interesting part about
And Larry's over there shaking his head. Larry, can I bring you into our conversation?
I was only shaking my head regarding the other co-defendants.
Yeah, well, the deal is, if the state is going to offer somebody in a capital case that applies to everybody under the law of parties, right?
It does, yes.
Everybody here is capital eligible, just like the Conley 7. Everybody there was capital eligible, and everybody there got a capital sentence, right?
Right.
So these other people wound up with plea bargains resulting in a life sentence and not capital punishment. It looks like the state would want something for that lesser offer.
Well, Ray, we've got five people charged with capital murder. So they're all,
That started out as Macbeth, has become Henry II.
You've got the shooter.
Third. Sorry, I've been corrected.
You've got the shooter. You've got the brothers, that is the husband and the husband's brother, the brother-in-law, who solicited the killing. Then you have the person who facilitated the introduction of Ruiz to the brothers.
Okay.
He's the person who was charged with capital murder.
So everybody's linked in the chain.
But the link becomes more tenuous when you consider that there's a person who made the introduction and for the solicitation to capital murder. He's now charged. And the person who was with Ruiz on the evening of the killing, okay, facilitated, that is, carrying him over there and being the getaway driver.
Yep, yep.
So there is a lesser involvement of many of those people to the killing than Ruiz is. And the two primary issues on capital, at least getting the death penalty, is future danger. We don't have a lot of information about how much of a future danger the other four people were. But it would be hard pressed for them to be as much of a future danger as Ruiz. And we also have the mitigation issue. Now, I was here primarily to talk about one issue, and that is the jury selection process. Now, because the case itself, when
now,
you look at
this is Bexar County.
This is Bexar County.
Okay, this is San Antonio, Texas.
Correct.
Continue.
There are some troubling issues with the case, seemingly troubling issues with the case as it relates to lawyers' performance. Because the appellate courts were pretty critical of the lawyers' performance, particularly on the state habeas case. So he's got the trial case where he's represented by lawyers. Then he has an appeal. Then he's got the state habeas. Then he goes into the federal remedies, the federal habeas, and then the appeal to the federal appellate court. He's gone through all of these, and a lot of the issues that he raised, particularly the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. As Mike has already pointed out, a counsel is deemed to be inefficient, deemed to be ineffective, if his performance is substantially subpar. And but for that subpar performance on behalf of the lawyer, the result would have been different. Well, the appeals courts were critical of the performance of these, particularly the state habeas lawyers. But that issue in going to the federal court, federal habeas, was actually procedurally barred. So even though he's ineffective, the issue is procedurally barred because it wasn't even brought up in the lower court, and the issue was not exhausted in the state court, which looks pretty bad for someone looking at a case like this. Say, wait a minute, we're talking about a man's life, but you know there were several issues of ineffective assistance of counsel that were brought up, but the two that he raised were not brought up, and so they couldn't be brought up in the federal habeas side. But there was one issue that did survive the courts looking at procedural barring, and that is the issue of jury selection. Okay, now and that raises the question of one juror by the name of Ms. Castro was one veneer person was removed for cause. The judge grants the state's motion to remove her for cause. And the exchange was pretty straightforward. But the defense raised the issue, well, she should not have been removed for cause. Now, a veneer person cannot be removed from the jury just because they express, if they voice an objection, a general objection to the death penalty, or if they have some sort of a conscious or religious objection to the death penalty. They can't be barred for that so long as they can follow the law. And so what happens is she, in her jury questionnaire, just said flat out, I'm against the death penalty. That doesn't solve it. Okay, because the lawyers get a chance, the lawyers and the
judge. To tidy that up.
Get a chance to ask her questions,
mm-hmm.
to find out if indeed she cannot follow the law. So she is examined both by the state and by the defense. And she says, well, you know, they ask the question, well, if you're instructed by the judge, you will follow the law, won't you? Well, yes, I will. Okay, but you're against the death penalty, aren't you? Well, yes, I'm against it. So what are you going to do? And so they did the volleying back and forth, okay? And so one of the Court of Appeals summarized her statement says, first she told the state, in effect, that she would never be a part of a jury that would impose the death penalty. She said that. Will never do that. And would vote to ensure that the person got life with no less than 35 years. That's the first thing she said. Then she told the defense, Ruiz's lawyers, that she could be fair because they want her.
Yeah, of course.
She could be fair. Well, of course she. Oh, yeah, I could be fair. And she listened to the evidence and then let the trial court decide. She said that. That's what she said. Then she told the state that she would know she'd be influenced if she was ever really given influenced by her
views. And this is back
views.
And forth with everybody in the same room at the same time.
It's going back and forth. And so finally the judge gets involved. And the judge asks her, so what are you going to do? She says, well, I tell you what I'm going to do. Once I'm out of here, I'm going to start up a group to oppose the death penalty. That's what I'm going to do. At that point, the judge goes ahead and grants the state's motion to remove her for a cause. And they would have used a strike on her anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, but that exchange.
Yeah, let's put this into context. I don't know how big this panel was, but it's more than 50 people.
A lot more than 50. Okay. Yes, yes.
And so we're talking about one juror being dismissed for cause as opposed to being stricken by the other side.
And we're talking about possible error in a capital case that might save a man's life. So the lawyers are looking back through and says, here's a nugget that we can use. And it actually gets through to the appeals court.
Okay.
And the appeals court looks at it and
says, keep that alive until you get to the appeals court.
They keep it alive and says, you know, she never should have been stricken for cause. Okay. That's their one hope. Okay. And the judges have to review it. And they review it and says, well, we don't know. We cannot place our judgment over the judgment of the judge in the court. And so everybody knows when you look at a record, it does not necessarily reflect what all the factors were. I mean, lawyers, I know so many lawyers who love the
drama.
Well, the movie My Cousin Vinny.
Yeah.
And there's one place in My Cousin Vinny where one of the defendants is being interviewed. And he's told, no, you shot the clerk. And he says, I shot the clerk? I shot the clerk? Well, when they read that back, he says, I shot the clerk.
Yeah, of course.
He said,
yeah.
I shot the clerk. Yeah. You don't know what...
You don't know the influx.
Just the tone, the appearance, the reaction. There are just so many factors that are involved. So the appellate court says, okay, you've got an issue. It's not like those other issues that we're not going to review because they're procedurally barred. This issue is not procedurally barred. We can review it. And when we review it, we find that the judge did all right. So we're going to pass judgment on this one, not the others, because we don't have to deal with that. But the one that you do have an appealable issue, we must consider it. And once we consider it, we give all deference to the trial judge
in
making that decision. Okay. And so that was the one issue that he had that at least was appealable. The others were not. Okay.
Mike, is that where you are on this?
I'm on the efficiency of counsel.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so he didn't raise all of those inefficiency of counsel issues.
They were procedurally barred.
The ineffective assistance of counsel issues. There were several inefficient assistance of counsel issues that were raised. But the one that had to do with, as Jim points out to us from time to time, that when you're looking at inefficient assistance of counsel, a lot of times we have historically focused on what the counsel did.
Yeah.
The focus is now getting to, since we've exhausted a lot of that, what did he fail to do?
Okay.
Okay, and the fail to do was he failed to examine the historical information about the defendant's past history, his upbringing. Now, his explanation was, I failed to investigate it because it might have hurt me if I introduced it. That's not good enough. Fail to investigate? You've got to investigate first before you can determine whether it's going to help or hurt
your client.
So this was a good issue. It just wasn't brought up at the appeal.
Mike, why wasn't that brought up?
Well, it wasn't brought up because, according to the defendant, he had an inefficiency of counsel. Now, that is correct. The Texas appellate courts basically said, and they didn't quite say he was inefficient, but they said there were certain things that they were questioning. It's very difficult time to judge a lawyer's strategy. And what Larry says is true. You have to investigate to make that determination. I don't think the record is clear on what kind of investigation there was. There was talks about reports being done. There was talked about doctor's reports being done. I'm not too
sure. Well, you had all this testimony from his friends and his girlfriend.
That's the next question, okay? Yeah. Because what the appellate court said, and the interesting issue is that, as Larry talked about, what the federal courts say is don't even come talk to us unless you exhausted all state remedies. And even though there were issues over here, and we're not making the decision in the federal court if it's good issues or bad issues, they just said we can't consider it because we're hearing it for the first time. So then his argument became my habeas corpus lawyer was efficient, which is the second way of coming back to inefficiency of counsel. And that's when the courts basically said that these other evidence, these other facts, there was no showing that it would have been a different result if these things came in. The part about this case which is interesting to me, it just seems like when five people commit a brutal murder, it's like a gang. The bad people who are... know what they're doing, know enough to plead guilty, and the dumb guy ends up going to trial and taking the rap? You just seem to think...
But, Mike, that happens every day in that courthouse.
But when you're talking about the death penalty...
I know.
You just seem like the jury needs to see all the people involved, and even though they might got life, if all these other people got life, maybe, and they saw the characters and the people involved...
I can tell you right now, Robert Pruitt is sitting in his death row cell listening to this show, all right? Not in his capital case, which happened in prison with the guard thing, which I think they framed him and hung it on because he was the most vulnerable person around. But in his original case that involved him, his brother, and his father. Michael was, number one, a kid, 16, 17-year-old kid. Everybody else was older and very experienced and been handled more and right. And they all got lighter sentences than he did because they beat it to the DA quicker.
And that's what I'm saying. It just seems like the jury needs to make a decision based on, even though people have
got
plea
bargains. By the way, hi, Robert. Hope you're doing well. Shoot me a kite.
It just seems like they should get to judge everybody and not just knowing that they got life, but they need to go through the trial, even though the sentence is done. They need to go to the trial, be examined, find out their background, find out the interrelation between the parties, because this guy could have been basically the only one brave enough to do it. And I've always said the one I'm more upset by is the guy who did it for the money. The husband did it for the money.
Larry's gnawing on his microphone trying to get in.
And I guess, Ray, the concern I have, because sometimes things just don't look right to outsiders, and we do them as lawyers.
Yeah.
But the thing that gets me the most about this case, but particularly in the appellate, the federal district court, a court of appeals, here's the concern I have. See, on February 18, 2004, Ruiz filed a federal habeas corpus claim.
And that was originally filed in a district court.
In the federal district court, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. But federal district courts have limited availability if they haven't exhausted. And so what he did was, he said, my lawyer, now for the first time, he says, my lawyer failed to present mitigating evidence regarding my abusive childhood. So the district court rejected that claim, saying it was procedurally defaulted because he didn't bring it up. And then the court goes further to say the court observed that Ruiz's claim of potentially, that the claim of ineffective was potentially meritorious, but we can't deal with it. Why? Because he says now when the court looks at it, they characterize the state's habeas corpus counsel's representation as appallingly inept and egregiously deficient. Nevertheless, the court rejected Ruiz's request for a stay while Ruiz returned to the Court of Criminal Appeals to raise the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. because the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to investigate was procedurally barred in the federal court. Okay, now that looks bad, but when you look at it, say, well, for one, Mike and I were discussing earlier that, you know, a person has a right to a trial.
Yep.
And to have a right to a trial, you've got to have
competent counsel.
But you don't have a right to an appeal. And you don't have a right to all of these habeas, all of these habeas proceedings. Okay? And so since you don't have a right to those, even if the lawyer may be ineffective, unless it becomes a violation of a basic constitutional right, you're out of luck on those. And so since Ruiz didn't bring those up in the state court and allow the federal court said you didn't bring them up in state court and allow the state court system to adjudicate those issues, then we can't deal with them. We don't know what they would have done because we're not them. But that's where it should have been brought up. And since it wasn't, we can't bring it up now. We can't adjudicate it now, so they are procedurally barred. But the one thing that did survive procedural barring was the issue on the jury selection. And on that one, the court looked at it and said, now, our judgment is it's all right.
Yeah. They ruled against him on the issue. There's some movement in the other room, and I always worry about what's going on. No, that was Trump was breathing into his microphone. He does that a great deal. The deal is that in this studio, I'm Ray Hill. You're listening to Execution Watch. It is March 7th in 2017, and we are inside the studio at 6:47. And as of this moment, we have no information that there has been any movement to proceed with this execution. The execution we're talking about is Rolando Ruiz. His family is gathered up outside the walls with Pat, and Pat is trying to keep us informed if the witnesses crossed the road and went into the execution chamber. She would call. Elizabeth is in there, iPhoning her fingers to the bone, trying to find out if she can find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. And so far, we have no word that this execution is going to proceed. We're going to be on the air for exactly 12 more minutes. And if that, nothing has happened by then, then we're going to go off of the air, and we'll have to read what, is it Michael Grazik? Is that the AP reporter in Huntsville? We'll read what Michael Grazik's got to say about the case on the AP and in the Chronicle in the morning. So here we are at this late hour, and there has been no action. Of course, as far as I'm concerned, as long as someone can keep on ventilating, that's a good sign. Paige, you've been chomping at the bit here. What do you bring to the table?
Well, we can discuss the issue about the inefficiencies of the habeas system. What we have here is we have the automatic appeal of a capital case to the Court of Criminal Appeals. Do not stop. Do not pass go.
Yeah, go into appeal.
Go straight appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeals. And then, in order to get jurisdiction to the federal court, you must file the state habeas, the Texas habeas petition. And every one of the capital cases that we have dealt with recently has had an issue about the failure at the state habeas level to include or consider or raise or discuss the issue that we're now all concerned about in front of the Fifth Circuit on the federal habeas and ultimately at the Supreme Court.
Well, frequently the way it happens is that the person who actually defends the inmate in the court is also the person who filed the habeas. And that seems to me a conflict of interest bigger than Dallas.
I have not noticed that recently. Most recently, I have noticed that there appear to be a group of very well qualified habeas lawyers that are filing the state habeas writs. Now, of course, this is a 1992
case. It was actually tried in 94, but this case has been cooking somewhere in the courts for 25 years.
Right. And so since it's been around as long as it has, yes, you know, perhaps we could have wished rather that we had some better representation.
Why don't we ask Monica? She hadn't been practicing law since that age of date. Monica, tell us, what do you think about all this?
Had she even been born yet?
It looks so, you know, at my age, I can't tell, you know.
Well, I honestly feel that the state did take in all the information that they had, and after reading what I read, and granted, there is, you know, differences in the way things are presented, but I feel that they probably believe that two people who had to hire somebody to kill somebody wouldn't be a killer themselves, but somebody who's okay with just taking money and taking a life that they don't even know.
Another factor that the district attorney's got, every capital case that he presents is going to cost him money. So you got five potential here. Well, let's spend money on this one and not on the rest of them. Economics is a factor. Is that, Larry? Isn't that sensible?
Depends on where you are, Ray.
Okay. Well, in Harris County, nobody cares.
Harris County.
Under Wade's Dallas, nobody cares.
Even to some extent, larger counties don't have the same degree of concern
some of them.
As the smaller counties do. Who are closer to the
living closer to the bone,
the money.
Yeah.
Okay. But one thing that Ruiz did, Ray, in this case, which I thought was pretty novel, is that he said, "Well, if you find that my habeas counsel, state habeas counsel, is ineffective, then you have denied me the right to a habeas because you appointed me court system."
Yeah.
This. Ineffective counsel.
Yeah.
So.
Hello, state.
It's state. It's your fault. I thought it didn't work.
Yeah.
But it was a novel approach. And again, this is what counsel is doing, trying to save a man's life.
All right. This happened 25 years ago. Would this be a capital case if it happened in Harris County today?
Yes.
And Ray, my concern, I've raised it with Jim several times, everything is based on, so much is based on prosecutorial discretion.
Yeah.
Okay.
And prosecutorial is enormous.
Under the former DA, I'd be unequivocal, yes. Under the new DA, I'm just not sure.
I agree.
I just don't know.
Well,
I
could not. I could not guess what Ms. Ogg
Well,
might
Paige,
do.
Paige, wait, before you get into that. Would this only be a capital case in this person's incident and not other co-conspirators in the act?
I think that because the facts that were presented at the punishment hearing, this one defendant is destined to be a capital, whether it were filed in Harris County or Bexar County or Dallas County. Or Tarrant County.
I was in Bexar County Jail one time, and the sergeant came to me and said, "What the hell do I do about a person on the next cell block with Tourette syndrome?" I said, "Oh, I can write you a policy on that." So here I am in Bexar County Jail as an inmate writing a policy on what Bexar County should do about Tourette syndrome's inmates. And they still, as far as I know, use my policies to this day. So when you start drawing a line between inmates and lawyers, crooks and the people that represent them and the guards that keep them and the district attorneys that prosecute, there's not a very thick line between those categories of people. We're all friends. If Larry Douglas walk up and say, "Well, I'm going to take this case because I know the judge." Well, you know all the judges and they all know you. You all went to the same law school, hang around the same cafeterias, drink the same brands of wine, exchange notes on it, smoke the same cigars. Well, I don't think Monica's smoking cigars yet, but she practices law long enough, she's going to get there. We have spent the last hour talking about the execution of a man that may or may not happen tonight. What do you think, Larry? You think they'll kill him?
I think it's likely, Ray. I don't see any reason not to. Okay, now the question you asked earlier, Ray, the other thing about today is that we do now have life without parole. Now, this guy would be dangerous even if he had life without parole, though, because he's dangerous to the people inside. But
Do you know that he's very popular on the row and that he has a following all over the world that are listening to the show right now on the Internet because he's been corresponding with people, does a little artwork, writes a little poetry?
But in answer to your question, I think that, you know, today it's likely that, you know, with his future that future dangerous sort of stands out in this case, right?
It's a booger.
It stands out.
It's a booger.
I think it's also a point that the incidents that happened in jail also happened after this incident that they were presenting in the punishment phase. So I feel that that's kind of gives a point to Ruiz in the fact that...
Well, Monica, have we treated you well?
Yes, very well, sir.
Did you enjoy doing
this? I enjoyed this very much, though. Thank you so much.
And we're able to pleasantly get out of here without a body to dispose of. That's always a good thing. My name is Ray Hill, and you're listening to Execution Watch on radio station KPFT in Houston. Tonight's program, of course, was produced by the very capable Elizabeth Stein. And Elizabeth Stein is a remarkably qualified producer because she's worked hard on this case. Of course, Jim Skelton didn't bring his voice down here, but his work showed up on many pieces of paper around this table. Thank you, Jim, for all this research. Monica stood in for Jim at the early part of the show. Larry Douglas participated. Michael Gillespie. Sharon Bass stepped right up because Jack Lee has... somehow managed to get a pass. And, of course, there's Paige Janik. She did her usual thing. I'm glad to get reports from Jennifer and from Pat, the loyal Pat in Huntsville. Thank you for doing that. Our engineer tonight in the studio is Bob Gardner. Our technical engineer is Otis McClay. And he is the one responsible for you people on the Internet being able to hear all of this in real time. It will show up on the website in a couple of days. And you can also listen to it in kpft.org's archive. The music is by Victoria Panetti, whose brother is on death row. He's crazy as a loon, and they're probably going to kill him anyway. Because being crazy does not protect you from the vengeance of the state of Texas. My name is Ray Hill. Thank you very much for listening. Don't ever get caught in one of these traps.